Am I my brother's keeper? A thought that is often on my mind, one that I find valuable and important to me, is the love that we have for our brethren. The many forms that that takes and the ways in which we're obliged to show that love through our actions. We all know the scriptures refer to us as part of one body. We read of this in 1 Corinthians 12 as well as in Romans 12:4. I'll just read Romans 12:4. For just as we have many members in one body, and all the members do not have the same function, so we, who are many, are one body in Christ, and individually members one of another. That's from the New American Standard. To use a modern example, we are all part of the same team. And teams work because healthy humans are made to be social creatures. Some may prefer to be more social and others less social, but it's a rare individual who avoids all human company all the time. There are many types of social groups or teams. Family is one such group, but humans gravitate to clubs, sports teams, clothing circles, church groups. The modern example these days is called meetups. And we do this for several reasons. We do it because we share a passion, because we crave to be part of a group. Some of us crave activity. And I think our membership in this group, in the Bible students, allows us to share in our passion, to feel like we belong to a higher family, a spiritual family. And it allows us perhaps to be ourselves and be understood in ways that our fleshly families, those who are not Bible students, might not always understand. We have been biologically programmed to recognize the power of groups. If this were not the case, mankind never would have come together in villages, towns, or cities. We would all be isolated, each in his or her own territory, just like prowling panthers, right? But we do crave to be a part of a community. Many of you have no doubt heard the proverb, "It takes a village to raise a child." There are many layers to this proverb, but at its heart, I think it speaks to both a concern for the moral well-being of our community, as well as the benefits that we gain from growing up a part of a diverse and yet close-knit community. You are no doubt aware that for many years, we chose to homeschool our boys, and all the praise and hard work for that certainly are credited to Jamie. But would you guess, what would you guess is the first concern raised when people discovered this was our plan? First question, every time. Well, where are you going to socialize with other children? Now, leaving aside that debate, actually, I want to focus simply on the fact that this question was asked because we all recognize the need. We recognize that working with and getting along with our fellow humans is essential in our society. And in times of crisis, we see humankind come together in supportive fashion. Think of the destruction of the World Trade Center, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, so many disasters, and humans come together. Perhaps you saw some footage, I think it may now have been a year or two ago, a bunch of strangers came in to rescue a family from a car overturned in a river. And a bunch of strangers came and helped them out. It's a heroic action, but it's not unique, right? Now, we as Christians and Bible students, we might not always get along, but just like we don't choose our earthly family, we don't choose our spiritual family. But when you get past that and accept that they are your family, then you can get on with what's important. I might fight with my brother. We still love each other. Now, we probably all had the same exact thought the moment the title of this presentation was announced. Actually, I know you did because Brother Jonathan jumped straight to it. When we think of the story of Cain and Abel, right? It's one of perhaps the best known stories, if only because the lesson is quite simple at its heart, and we learned it in Sunday school at a very early age. We think of the main lesson of spending our time on things pleasing to the Lord versus spending our time on things that we want to do. And we think of the jealousy of Cain when his offering was not considered as pleasing as his brother's. Now, there's more to the story, but what we really want to focus on is Cain's response. He has slain his brother in a fit of jealous rage. And in Genesis 4:9, we read, "The Lord said to Cain, 'Where is Abel, your brother?' And he said, 'I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?'" Now, the parents in this room probably can't even imagine how this is said. Am I my brother's keeper? That irritated response is like, what does it matter to you? Or you probably know better than I do. Maybe he was being sarcastic, maybe he thought it was a reasonable response. I mean, is it truly his job to know where his brother is? On that simple level, I think we might agree he's not responsible to be aware of his brother's whereabouts at all times. That would probably be unreasonable. But on a deeper level, I would claim the answer is absolutely yes, he is his brother's keeper. On that deeper level, we might rightly assume his brother's well-being should have been very important to him. We might conclude that his every action toward his brother should have been grounded in a loving concern, and that he would never intentionally wrong or hurt his brother. In that sense, he absolutely ought to have been his brother's keeper. Don't we feel some sort of responsibility toward our brother? Are we, in some manner of speaking, our brother's keeper? But the trick here, the part that's not so clear, is in distinguishing how far do we go in the service of our brethren, and at what point do we need to restrain ourselves and let them travel their own path and make their own choices. And that's not the only challenge. We also have to walk a fine line whereby we tell them the things they need to hear, even perhaps they don't want to hear them. But ideally, we need to find a way to do this without being cruel or hurtful. Proverbs 27:9. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, so a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. We must ask ourselves, how much help is enough help? And how careful must we be of our brethren's feelings? Is it possible that looking out for the spiritual well-being of our brethren might necessitate hurting their feelings? I don't believe there are any easy answers here. In fact, a lot of this is going to boil down to your personal choice. But I'd like to take a look at some of the possibility, or the possible effects our actions might have upon our brethren. Let's break down the possibilities into four different scenarios. And I'm just going to ask you to imagine this. Imagine a box, four quadrants. And the four possibilities are that you and your brother both understand and agree upon what is best for them. Option two, you and your brother are both wrong about what's best for them. Option three, your brother knows what's best for him, but you incorrectly feel otherwise. And four, you actually do know what's best for your brother and he doesn't. I'd like to take a moment to think through the pros and cons of these scenarios. Now the easy one is you and your brother both understand and agree upon what's best for them. There's no argument here. No action needs to be taken. No great conflict is likely to arise. And the second option is rather easy to address as well. We don't always know all the answers for ourselves or others. In the case where we're both mistaken, I think it's better to allow a brother or a sister. I keep saying brother just because it's easier, brethren. But it's better to allow a brother or sister to make their own mistakes. If we're both in the wrong, we all do the best we can. Of course, we don't know when we're in this situation, but clearly the better path when we're both wrong is to allow a brother the freedom to make their own mistakes. It's with options three and four we have to tread carefully. Where one brother is right and the other is wrong, there is no magical answer key by which we can recognize who is who. And so we come to a place where we might find ourselves in conflict with our brother. Though you might legitimately desire to look out for your brother and guide him or her in the right way, at least some of the time you are going to be the one who's wrong. And therefore you need to ask, what kind of mistake would you rather make? If you'll indulge me for a moment, I'll share with you a mathematical principle related to statistics. And it has to do with our ability to estimate if a condition is true or false. And it's the same quadrant system I was just describing to you. A condition may actually be true or false. Your brother may actually be wrong or right. And likewise, we may identify that condition as true or false, wrong or right. So an example, for example, to share with you is, there may actually be a fire in the building. There may not be a fire in the building. That's a fact. We may believe there's a fire in the building. We may believe there is no fire in the building. That is our interpretation. And they can match up in four different ways. there's a fire and we believe there's a fire. There's not a fire and we believe there's not a fire. Those are fine. But what happens when we decide that we want to make sure everybody is always safe and therefore we call fire at the slightest indication that a fire may exist? It keeps everyone safe, but we often will find we're calling fire when there is none. We're wasting the time and efforts of the people in the building as well as the firefighters. So then we might say, well, we're better off not calling fire unless we have absolute concrete proof in front of us. And that way no one will be called unnecessarily. But now we risk missing a fire until it's been burning for some time. There's a trade-off. And so there's greater property damage and danger. And so that is the statistical trade-off. It's a known thing that if you are in a hurry to call fire, there's one set of consequences, some good, some bad. If you're hesitant to, it's just a different set. And the way we describe it in statistics is trying to reduce one type of error guarantees increasing the other type of error. That's just the way it is. And in reality, we're not all given the information we need to make the proper choices. We know that. Now, this dichotomy is neither good nor bad. It is simply reality. When our imperfect brains are forced to deal with imperfect information. Returning to our judgments about our brethren, we believe the same circumstance exists. If we're too anxious to correct our brother, we are going to overstep our understanding and our authority, at least on some occasions. But on the other hand, if we're too hands-off, we will certainly not be doing our duty to build each other up. And we know it's our duty. We read in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 11. 1 Thessalonians 5:11, therefore encourage one another and build up one another, just as you also are doing. Of course, we want to do our best to find that balance. And our comfort level with that balance is going to be different for every person in this room. This is unfortunately not a question that has a nice, simple, right or wrong answer. It's a continually shifting judgment that we make based upon all of our previous decisions and experiences. And every time we make a mistake, we just hope we grow from it. The goal here today is simply to call attention to that choice, because it is a choice. And in so doing, we hope to encourage you all to make more informed decisions, or more conscious decisions. Consider for a moment Paul's discussion of meat offered to idols. 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. Verses 4, 7, and then 7 through 11. 1 Corinthians 8:4. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. Skipping to verse 7. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do eat. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone sees you, who have knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. We know what Paul is advising here, that the stronger brother or sister ought to recognize when their actions might stumble another. And take care, lest they inadvertently cause harm. But let us give this a little deeper thought as well. For example, in this case, who is correct? Is meat offered to idols truly defiling? Paul assures us the answer is no. So let us imagine another brother, one who is not in danger of being stumbled, but rather one who chastises the brother eating meat, merely because the law says so, and you have no business thinking outside of the box. Is that an acceptable action? Are we permitted to intrude upon another brother's liberty in Christ? As long as we're convinced that we're right. That can be a slippery slope, because if being convinced that we're right is all we need, it's even easier if we just shut our eyes and avoid ever learning otherwise. Brother Russell points out in reprint 3:1-4:4, the beginning of love is sure to build us up substantially. Avoiding the inflation of pride in all the various graces of the Spirit, including meekness, gentleness, patience, long-suffering, brotherly kindness, knowledge, wisdom from above, and the spirit of a sound mind. It is altogether too easy to convince ourselves that the correcting of our brother is the most important thing. But you see, that's only true if we're also exercising love toward our brother. If we're exercising meekness, gentleness, patience, long-suffering, brotherly kindness, knowledge, wisdom, the spirit of a sound mind. If you're correcting your brother and you're not exhibiting meekness, gentleness, patience, etc., are you really doing the Lord's will? Let me tell you a story. There was once a brother of great zeal, but he tended to highly intellectualize his faith, a great deal more than the average Bible student. And this approach led him to ask questions that many of us are not comfortable asking. Now at this point, is that wrong? I would claim it's not. We're all permitted our own questions. We each have an individual walk, and I have no more right to tell some of you more intellectual than they have to tell me to be less intellectual. However, this brother's approach became increasingly evident to other members of the class, and he presented thoughts quite far outside what we might call the conventional bounds. And in response, he was approached and told rather harshly that he really needed to cut it out. And when the brother who was so harsh was questioned about this approach, the response was, "It's not my job to worry about his feelings." Now I ask you, is that so? Is that really the case? Let us look at the two types of error that might arise from this interaction. On the one hand, we might come down so severely on the brother in question that they're discouraged from participating in class. They might decide to meet elsewhere or stop meeting altogether. So that's the type of potential error and potential consequence. The other potential error is we don't react, or we don't react severely enough, and there's no change made. And perhaps this brother might be making other brethren in the class uncomfortable. But my real question here for me is, which response is more recoverable? If the brother is still in class and we need to ask again gently for a change to be made, can we still do this? Absolutely. But once that brother is gone, what are the chances we can convince them to return? Now to be clear, I think the severity of the circumstances is absolutely important here. If a brother is teaching egregious error, then I understand harsh measures may be warranted. And that's where the judgment call comes in again. If a brother is encouraging serious error in study, then it is in our best interest to end it firmly. But that's for serious error. This requires thought, discussion, prayer, should never be entered into lightly. We are our brother's keeper, and if our actions cause serious harm to our brother, then we are responsible. Further along in the same reprint, this is again reprint 3144, The apostle proceeds in his argument to show that it is not the food we eat that makes us acceptable to God, neither our abstaining from any particular food. Our relationship to God is that of the new creation, a heart relationship. And the blessing which the Lord gives us is as newly begotten children. In this example of the eating of meat offered to idols, neither brother is more correct than the other. We must focus less on being right or wrong, and more on our relationship with God, our heart condition, our own walk. We can look out for our brother, but we can't force him to believe exactly as we do. We can't force him to come to the same conclusions as we do. If after we present our case, our brother continues to hold a different interpretation, we still must carry on as a family, as a body, in love. Quoting again from the reprint, the same reprint again. True, whom the Son makes free is free indeed, and we all should seek to stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ makes free. But it is also true that we need to be on guard lest we use our liberty in such a manner as would stumble others more weak than ourselves, not so able to use the liberty of Christ discriminatingly. The liberty wherewith Christ makes free may be viewed from two standpoints. If it gives us liberty to eat without restraint, in a manner that the Jews were not at liberty to eat, it gives us liberty also to abstain. And whoever has the Spirit of Christ and is seeking to follow in his steps has already covenanted to the Lord to use his liberty, not in the promotion of his fleshly desires ambitions and appetites, but in self-sacrifice, following in the footsteps of the Master, seeking to lay down his life even on behalf of the brethren for their assistance. How different are these two uses of liberty? Its selfish use would mean self-gratification regardless of the interests of others. Its loving use would prompt to self-sacrifice in the interests of others. So we are warned to not use our liberty in such a way we might stumble our brethren. But notice also what we are not told here. Nowhere does it say, use your liberty to prevent brethren from stumbling others. We're not told to control our brethren. We are not to berate our brethren. We are not to criticize our brethren. We are to love our brethren. That's not always easy. And love doesn't mean ignoring faults, but it means dealing with issues in a loving manner. If we, being concerned about our brother, possibly feel that we're in a position to correct him, well, first of all, doesn't that assume that we are interpreting that we are the stronger in this regard? And ignoring the fact that we may be right or wrong, if this is so, doesn't the obligation to not stumble our brother fall on us? Have you ever seen someone relatively young in the faith encounter criticism by a more established brother or sister? I have. I can think of several who no longer meet regularly with the class because of the harsh words and actions they have encountered. And I don't think the harsh words were encountered with a poor spirit. I think, in other words, I don't think the things were said in a spirit of anger, necessarily. I'm not going to make that judgment call. They may have been loving. It doesn't matter. If they chase someone away, it does not matter where your heart was. Sometimes we can be so caught up in doing what is right, in correcting what appears to us to be an obvious wrong, or perhaps sometimes getting what we want, that we don't consider so much how something might best be done. Remember the words of James 1:19. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. If we are slow to speak and slow in our criticism, it gives us time to consider the viewpoint of our brother. We can then make an attempt to formulate a response that says what needs to be said, but does so in an obvious spirit of love and concern for our brother. There's a bit of advice I'd like to share with you. Perhaps many of you have heard this previously, so consider it a reminder. When you hear a comment in a meeting and you disagree, do you think the most effective way to have a dialogue about the issue is to lead off your discussion with the words, "That brother is so very wrong. Let me tell you how to understand that." Of course not. But sometimes we say, "I disagree." Now, I've had conversations with brethren about this, and they say, "Well, that's not necessarily wrong. That shouldn't hurt someone's feelings." Well, we talk about should or shouldn't. That's tricky. If I am speaking with, who shall I pick out of the room here? Brother Jonathan. I and Brother Jonathan have a good relationship. So if he says that, I'm not going to take it poorly. That's critical. I think I'm jumping ahead, so we'll come back to that. But perhaps we may try to keep in mind alternative ways of saying things such as, "Well, that's an interesting thought. Can you help me understand how that would fit with this verse over here?" I think we're still trying to say, "How does it fit with this verse?" without being antagonistic. Or maybe, you know, "I also like this thought that says, etc." You see, the how we do things can drastically change an outcome where interpersonal communication is involved. Can just anybody give you correction? If a stranger in the store tells you, "You should really dress nicer," how would that strike you? Even if it's your neighbor, there are certain things you can and cannot say. It boils down to a matter of trust. In order to give correction effectively, you must give that correction from a position of trust. And so this is another important piece of the puzzle. In order to best serve our brethren, we must earn their trust. We have to have a strong relationship with our brother before trying to tell them things they don't want to hear. For example, and I was talking about Brother Jonathan, but I use Brother Jerry Black in our class as an example because he is as thick-skinned as they come. He may not agree with me, but I have every confidence in the strength of our relationship where he'll at least listen to what I had to say. Without that relationship, it is altogether too easy to ignore things that are disagreeable. Because you know at that moment, when you have that person in the store that says you should dress nicer, boom, there's a wall up, you don't care what they have to say or why anymore. But once you have the relationship, now we at least listen. Proverbs 27:6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. When we have taken the time to establish a strong and trusting relationship, even the words that are tough to hear can be considered faithful, whereas there is no value at all in anything that comes from our adversaries, even if it is sweet and kind. Building trust is not a simple process. Even when we're starting from a neutral position, for example, you first meet somebody, it's even more difficult if you're trying to repair a damaged relationship. So one first step is to know yourself better. If you're not honest about your feelings and your intentions and your motivations with yourself, you will not be honest about those towards others. And another important step is to walk the walk. We often know what we should do, and we often tell our brethren we love them and are happy to see them, but do we show them? Do we greet our brethren with a smile? Do we go out of our way to show interest in them? Do we exercise patience when we're not in agreement, or do we quickly grow frustrated with them? Do we show trust in them by giving our brethren the benefit of the doubt? Do we encourage them when they speak up in the meeting? Are we even aware sometimes how we might come across harshly? In order to develop trust, we should also demonstrate trust in our brethren by being open about our thoughts and feelings. Be open even when you worry about being judged, about being wrong, about being hurt. Testimony meetings are really nice for those sorts of interactions. If you don't embrace that vulnerability, you put up a barrier between you and your brethren. It may not be visible, but it can be felt. And it will subtly prevent trust from growing beyond a certain point. Furthermore, we need to be open to feedback from our brethren. If our first reaction to constructive criticism is defensiveness, we will quickly train our brethren that we are not interested in listening. At some point, they will stop sharing constructive criticism because it's doing so little good. It's a hard lesson to learn. Even when you have a valid defense, being defensive is still bad. At least as a first response, it conveys an impression you don't really understand the point. You don't care about the feelings of your brethren, and it might be construed more as a power struggle than a dialogue. Remember, again, this is not about being right or wrong. This is about building a safe relationship where brethren feel that you are not only willing to have them approach you about their concerns, but you welcome it. If being right damages the relation you have, I believe this is referred to as winning the battle, but losing the war. And lastly, show respect for your brethren by allowing them the freedom to hold their own interpretations. If we put unnecessary pressure on our brethren by expecting them to agree with our perspective, it will only serve to push them away and build walls between us. All these actions make slow, very measured progress toward building trust. And it's not a process that takes a day or a week or a month. It builds slowly over perhaps years. It's interesting to note that Brother Russell, once again, reprint 3144, adds that if we change the behavior of our brethren due to pressure we inflict upon them, without having changed their understanding and their beliefs through a loving dialogue, we actually risk putting them in a position where we are encouraging them to compromise their beliefs to go along with us. We don't want to do that. Quoting from that same reprint, one might, without violation of conscience, eat meat that had been offered to idols or even sit at a feast in an idol temple, without injury to his conscience, but the other, feeling that such a course was wrong, might endeavor to follow the example of a stronger brother, and thus might violate his conscience, which would make it a sin to him. Every violation of conscience, whether the thing itself be right or wrong, is a step in the direction of willful sin. It's a downward course, leading further and further away from the communion and fellowship with the Lord, and into grosser and grosser transgressions of conscience. Thus the apostle presents the matter, for through thy knowledge he that is weak perisheth, the brother for whose sake Christ died. Skipping a bit farther down, the question is not, would it be a sin to eat the meat offered to idols, but would it be a sin against the spirit of love the law of the new creation to do anything which could reasonably prove a cause of stumbling to our brother. If our greatest concern is for the welfare of our brethren, we must not only consider what we know to be truth, but also how we go about building one another up and how we go about correcting one another. Let's look at some of the interpersonal struggles of the brethren in Corinth. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1, 7, and 8. Does any one of you, when he has a case against his neighbor, dare to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Actually, then, it is already a defeat for you, that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? On the contrary, you yourselves wrong and defraud. You do this even to your brethren. It is interesting to consider this from the perspective of someone who feels it's their duty to correct. Do they consider it better to suffer injustice than to risk being the perpetrator of injustice? He says right here in Corinthians, why not rather be wrong before taking that step? I'm having to skip around because we're running out of time already. So bear with me, brother. Returning to 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. Knowledge is important, but not as important as our actions. True love will put our brethren first and will concern itself not only with their spiritual health, but with their emotional health and safety. Now we don't have time to get into it, but lest you get the impression that I'm saying we should not exercise our good judgment, I'm not saying that. I want to bring your attention to some of Brother Russell's words in the sixth volume. I direct you to page 413. We don't have time to read it. But it addresses the fact that we do need to exercise good judgment. What it comes down to, brethren, is that we are to be our brother's keeper, but we need to truly understand what that means before we act on our convictions. We're a family. We look out for one another. We worry about one another. We care about each other's well-being. My father-in-law once shared a thought that I found fit very nicely with the theme today. It has to do with 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. Obviously, this is the love chapter, and so serving our brethren in love is, of course, fitting. But let's take a look specifically at the first verse of 1 Corinthians 13. I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but if I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but do not have love, I become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And so the thought shared, which I really appreciated, was, look at this in reverse. What does it mean to be a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal? If you're making a lot of noise, and harsh noise at that, you are just calling attention to yourself. That's not what we should be doing. Look at Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. Again, we won't read it all, but Matthew 6, starting from verse 1, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. If we're being noisy and harsh, putting ourselves at the forefront of conversation, we're not truly showing the love we need to show our brethren. Instead, consider 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 11 through 15. Therefore, encourage one another and build up one another, just as you also are doing. But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. See that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. Our goal at this time is not to put down or openly challenge any individual, but rather to ask each of us to do some soul searching, to perhaps prick the conscience, to ensure that we all strive to demonstrate our love for our brethren, not through the dominance of a great degree of knowledge, but by showing them the way we believe and by showing them the strength of our convictions through our loving actions and attitude. And so we leave you with the words of Romans 14:19. So that we pursue the things which make for peace and the building up of one another. Amen.